This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I wanted to do the talk tonight about these efforts guarding the mind and abandoning the process of abandoning the causes of suffering and cultivating the antidotes, the causes of happiness, and sustaining the causes of happiness in our mind and our life. Maybe I'll do it next time, because on the way in, two people that interacted with me said hello. We're talking about death and suicide and grief. So I thought maybe we would just shift to an exploration of our relationship to death, our relationship to loss, to grief, the reality that we live in, and where people that we care about will die. I mean, how many? I don't know what the statistic is of the hundreds of thousands of people that die every day. Something, I don't know what the number is. But that, you know, just death surrounds us. And that most of the time we get to go through our lives a little bit in denial about it, until it is close, till it's a friend, till it's a family member, or a pet, or, you know, something or someone that you care about. Even if there's a general sense of compassion for loss and death on the planet, a general sense that people are dying, people are starving to death, people are killing themselves, people are overdosing. The press has been giving some attention to the opiate epidemic, more people, more drug addicts dying these last few years than ever in history, more overdoses, more deaths. Probably half of the room here is addicts in recovery, since I'm a recovering person, and so much of our community are people in recovery. Not everybody. There's a whole bunch of what we like to refer to as normies in here. People that just have the normal suffering of life, not the addictive suffering. But I think especially for people, for addicts, death can often be very close, and people that we have been very close to dying, overdosing, committing suicide. I think it's certainly a higher level of mortality rate amongst addicts. But nobody doesn't know death. Everybody knows death on one level or another. That just reminds me of this story that the Buddha, or that's told about the Buddha, where a woman whose child has died comes to the Buddha and holding the corpse of her dead child and says, you know, you're this enlightened being, bring my child back to life. And he says, I cannot do that. It's not who I am. It's not within my power. But she doesn't believe in him. She keeps begging and just in this, you know, grief, just begging, please, please. And he finally says to her, well, go into the village, and if you can bring me back a mustard seed from one of the homes in the village. From a family that has not known death. If you can find me a mustard seed from a family who hasn't known any death, then I'll bring your child back to life. And so she goes, you know, carrying the corpse of her child door to door, asking, you know, have you known death? Have you known death? And everybody says, yes, grandma, grandpa, my children have died, my friends have died, we've all known death. And so, and eventually, of course, this is the teaching. that she needed to receive, and she comes back to the Buddha and says, "Okay, I get it. I'm, you know, crazy with grief around the death of my child. Feels unbearable, and I understand the teaching that you're giving me, that we all know death, that nobody doesn't know it." And of course it's much more, feels much more tragic when it's a young person, when it's a child. Much different than somebody, an elderly person who's lived out their life dying. There's no Buddhist precedence for this, but I think I made this up to comfort myself around children dying. And I'll share it with you. I think it's a little bit delusional, but I'm going to share it with you anyways. It's said that in Buddhism, there's different levels of enlightenment. That sometimes if you practice deeply within this lifetime, you'll reach a place where it's called stream entry, where you'll only have 7 incarnations left until nirvana. That's it. Come back 7 more times and then you're done. Which is nice. It's a weird religious proposition. 7 more incarnations. Stream entry. And then there's the non-returners who have to play out the rest of this life. Live out the karma in this lifetime, and at death you'll have parinirvana. You will enter the deathless, the awakened, and you will not have to take rebirth again. Of course, all of Buddhism taught within a multiple life, reincarnation, rebirth view. And then there's the non-returner, live it out. And then there's the once-returner, which is, or it goes stream entry, once-returner, non-returner, arahant. So once-returner means that you're very close to liberation. You're almost done with your greed, hatred, and delusion. Your karma is almost purified, but you're going to have to take rebirth one more time. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a long incarnation to burn off the karma that you need to burn off to experience your final nirvana, liberation. So I took that philosophy to say, well, maybe that's what's happening when young people die. Maybe they are once returners that had the karma, and I think I take this like from only the good die young. Like, maybe, I mean, I don't know, I think I'm probably wrong, but anyways, maybe that these are actually Buddhas that had done so much work in a past incarnation that they didn't need to live a long, miserable life like the rest of us. That they got the teaching at such a young age, they purified their karma so quickly that their karma was done. That their work was done. Now I'm pretty skeptical of that because it comforts me. And I generally feel like anything that is comforting is delusional. And that the truth is usually pretty disturbing and difficult to bear. So I wouldn't ask you to believe that, but I'm just sharing part of my process and part of how I've landed in Buddhism around the death of so many young people around me. I was so suicidal from such a young age. By the time I was 5, I was contemplating suicide, and I believed in reincarnation. Dad believed in reincarnation. He said that that's what was happening here, and I thought, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Just like the cartoons. Wile E. Coyote reincarnates like 3 times an episode. You die, and then you are there again. Donald Duck's getting his head blown off all the time, but he's always there in the next episode. Cartoons believe in reincarnation too. And I thought that if I killed myself, I didn't think it was lights out, but I thought that I could start over, then I could. I don't know, I think I thought about it a little bit as like a game, like, see what kind of family you get next time. See what kind of incarnation you have next time. Like, maybe it'll be different. Maybe your parents won't be dirty hippies next time. Maybe your parents, you know, whatever, different. That, and it's, again, it's that craving. Like, I want it to be different. I want to have a different experience. At some point, practicing Buddhism, suicide no longer held much of a relief for me. When I started to really start to grasp karma, and that what we're dealing with here is an unfolding of our personal momentum, our karma, our actions, and the fruit of our actions, and that ending this physical experience doesn't end our karma, and that we would actually bring it with us into, if rebirth is what's happening here, that, you know, we'd bring our karma with us. And then at that point I was like, oh man, suicide's not much of a relief, perhaps. Maybe that shit doesn't even work. Right? Because, like, we want to kill ourselves to get out of the suffering that we're in. Which makes sense. I mean, I feel like suicide makes a lot of sense. That the mind suggests it, and it's this place of, like, you're in pain, you don't want to be in pain, and the mind that says you're going to always be in pain, and the only way out is to get rid of the body. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, there's a momentum going on that's beyond the body, that doesn't depend on a body, and that will just take a new form. And so, it's not rest in peace. It's reincarnate. It's rebirth in I don't know what the... in the direction of the momentum that we've created. Again, I don't have... I don't think it's important for you to believe in reincarnation. If it makes sense to you, cool. It is what the Buddha taught. It mostly makes sense to me. And when we start thinking about death, what happens from a Buddhist perspective, that's what's happening here. We're not these bodies. You know, most of you know the five reflections of Buddhism, five daily practices, acknowledging that we're subject to sickness, we're subject to death, we're subject to aging and loss, where loss is inevitable. In this lifetime, you know, we'll be separated from everything that we hold near and dear. Everything's impermanent. All relationships end, one level or another. The death is natural. It's not a punishment. It's not a tragedy. Some of the time it feels very tragic, but often it's just the natural process of taking birth. At some point there will be death. One of the teachings of the Buddha says, death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. How long of an incarnation we're going to have in this form, we don't know. It's actually unknowable. And that our actions, this is karma, our karma is our only true possession. The only thing that we take with us is how we have shown up, how we have reacted, how vigilant we've been, how much we've abandoned greed and hatred and delusion, and how much we've cultivated wisdom and compassion. That's what we own. You own your wisdom, and you own your hatred. You own your compassion, and you own your craving, your clinging. that we have, especially when you've been introduced to the Dharma and you've done some mindfulness practice, you see, oh, I have the ability to purify my karma. How much am I going to do that? How much am I going to train my mind? How much am I going to change my relationship to the inevitable grief, loss, death that we will all experience on one level or another? So yeah, Buddhism really fucked up suicide for me personally. I don't think it's a relief. And I remember when one of my best friends died. So many, you know, with these overdoses, when your friends are addicts and they overdose, it's always the question, was it an intentional overdose? Was it suicide or was it an accident? And it's hard to know, and watching the mind go back and forth of, you were a good junkie, you should have known better. That must have been intentional. But when somebody's been clean for a little while and relapses and they think that they can inject what they used to inject, or they get bad dope or whatever it is, accidents do happen. And I can remember when my friend died, and I wanted to believe that he was out of the pain that he was in. I wanted that comforting philosophy of rest in peace. You're in a better place. And I can remember just being like, man, you fucked up. You have to keep, now you gotta go through puberty again. You think our childhoods were messed up this time? You got to do this whole thing over? Like, you had the opportunity to get free, and you were, you know, impatient or whatever it was. And I just started doing forgiveness practice because I saw that I had some resentment for him. I felt abandoned. I just started doing a lot of forgiveness practice for him, but death wasn't comforting it. I don't believe that it's like, oh, you're in a better place, or your pain is over. Physical pain, maybe. But I believe what the Buddha is teaching here, which is that your actions are your only possession and you take them with you. And that there's momentum that's created that continues beyond this body. Which hopefully, I think believing it for me inspires me to stay in the Dharma and stay practicing and stay vigilant and stay in the process of developing wisdom and compassion and abandoning greed and hatred and I don't know how much more I have to say about it. I'm interested in your thoughts, your experience of how to turn towards something like this, that there's something about the mind that just wants to deny it. Our culture is really good at denying it. It's why, and you heard in the meditation instructions tonight, in the first foundation of mindfulness, after the breath awareness, after the body awareness of the four elements in the body, the instruction is visualize a corpse. Think about death and acknowledge your own mortality. Become friendly, become intimate, become aware of death. And not only our death, but everyone else's too. And then the intention, I believe the intention here is to bring a preciousness to life. to bring a preciousness of like, oh man, I'm gonna die. I better get my shit together. You're gonna die. I better be, you know, I better use this as an opportunity to be kind, to be present, to be friendly, to be forgiving. To put a I think the term preciousness is what comes to me. That, it's not, we can't rely on some future, some imagined future. And yeah, the mind. How do you like this talk? Right? There's something about it that's like, oh, I don't want to talk about this. And that some, maybe part of what the Dharma is asking us to do by really looking at reality and not comforting. Like I said, I see how I want to use the Dharma to comfort myself. Oh yeah, children, they're just non-returners. They're like bodhisattvas. That's why they die young. They're like in fully. They're just more enlightened than us. It's those of us who don't have enough wisdom that have to live long lives. You gotta suffer through it and experience all of the death and loss of it. You know, like if you die young, it's because you're super wise. It's just comforting. I don't know. That could be true, but probably not true. I don't know. My father used to say, this practice is like asking us to live with your heart open in hell. When you really turn towards the death, the grief, the sorrow, not with a denial and a suppression and an ignoring it and pretending like the sadness isn't here, but opening fully, turning towards the pain of loss, of grief. And that's what we're really being asked to do, you know, when somebody dies. Not to make it all spiritual and they're in a better place, but to say, this is brutally painful, this loss. And my sense is that even, of course, the more, if we're really attached and we have all of that judgment of like, this is wrong, it is, we can create a neurotic grief, an unnecessary level of suffering on top of the loss. But I think that even with a pretty wise, non-attached perspective, grief is just a natural and healthy and normal response to loss. There's a place in the suttas, sometimes attributed to the Buddha, might have been Sariputta or Moggallana or one of the senior arahants, enlightened beings that was around the Buddha. And one of them dies. And so these are like the homies that have been practicing together for 40 years, living together, practicing the Dharma, hardcore Sangha homies. And one of them dies first. And the other enlightened beings, free from craving, aversion, delusion, says in the sutta, it feels like the sun has been extinguished from the earth, like the light is gone. This is an enlightened being's response. No clinging, but a grief that says, I feel the absence of this. And I have the grief of it. It feels like a real loss, like the sun has been removed. And so our practice becomes compassion for that pain, becomes I've always done a lot of forgiveness practice around death. And I always encourage people, when somebody that you know dies, maybe do some forgiveness for them. Do some forgiveness practice, because even if You don't want to acknowledge that you have some resentments towards the dead? Just check it out a little bit. Check it out. Is there anything there, any unfinished business, any levels of compassion and forgiveness that can take place in your heart? So that we can be with the pure grief and not the anger on top, not the resentment on top, just the pure sadness. Sadness is the appropriate response, I believe. I don't think we get to the place where we're so enlightened that we don't feel sad, that we don't feel emotions. I think that they're healthy, that they're natural. It's how we relate to them, how we respond. What kind of thoughts, questions, or comments does this bring up for you? Please.
So as much as I want to be Christian and believe God is real, I want to believe we're going to reincarnate. And it feels different, but it feels similar in that they tell us we're coming back, or we're somewhere else, or we're still us in some form. And I see in you that you have found a connection to that. And I find I'm inclined towards like a more existential bent. And I have a lot of fear around this meaning nothing at the end. And trying to be good and love and just be here as long as I get to be here. There's this like feeling of like, why? Just don't bother. You're gone at some point. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you can talk about how to relate to that emotion and how to still live a meaningful life, even though you've found a belief system.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my sense is that, I mean, if we look at karma or just our actions, how we show up in life, and say, you know, if I show up with hatred and greed and self-centeredness, this life that I'm living right now is going to be miserable. But if I show up with kindness and compassion and generosity and love and service, and actually this life that I'm living right now is going to be less miserable and have more happiness in it. Whether or not there's any sort of continued existence, I don't think that it makes this life meaningless if there's no afterlife, if there's no rebirth. I think that it, personally, that what we're doing right now, how we're affecting people right now, how we're showing up, that this is what's totally important. And I don't think it matters so much. I mean, when we're talking about suicide, is it a relief or not? Yes, for me, I have to get into, is there some sort of continued existence? But when we're just talking about how do we show up moment to moment in our relationships and our responsibilities in our life, here and now, positive action, attitude, wisdom makes this life better, whether or not there's a next life, whether or not there's an after experience. So, and I know that for sure. I don't know if there's rebirth for sure, but I know that mindfulness and forgiveness and compassion and these practices drastically changed my reality in this lifetime. If there's rebirth, I'm sure I'm going to get a better rebirth. Bonus. If there's no rebirth, that's okay too. I'm going to live this life out fully, saying, how can I help people and how can I show up and how can I be kind and generous? And so for me, it doesn't really matter. When I'm sitting up here teaching Buddhism, I have to say this is what Buddhism teaches. I don't think that it changes. If anything, some of the Buddhist stuff I think hasn't comforted me as much as like pulled away some of my comfort. Like I was talking about the once returner, but when I really started to think, like, if rebirth is really what's happening here, it was discomforting, not comforting to me.
I think my mind is different than yours.
Yeah.
I think I crave meaning. So I find underneath enjoying being kind and loving, because I agree with you.
Right.
Obviously, that's a much better life.
Right.
There's an internal fear of everything being like meaningless at the end. And I don't think you have the answer to that.
Right. No, I think you're right, because I am, my default is probably much more nihilistic. Nothing means anything. And then the Dharma comes into my life and says, well, maybe it means something. Right. So I think you're right. Like, our minds are, it's not important for it to mean something to me as it is important for it to mean something to you. Yeah.
For you, I find myself in like debilitating fear a lot about the fact that we don't know what's, like, no one really knows what's going to happen when we die, and I actually sometimes find it like very distracting from the rest of my life, and sometimes I just don't understand how, like, everyone's not walking around just in constant panic and fear about the fact that we just really have no idea. Mm-hmm. Like, it could be anything. It could be, you know, what some people say, like, the worst, most terrible torture. It could be nothing. It could be, like, our brains trapped in a little jar. So I guess I have two questions. First, like, does someone deal with this kind of, like, terrified feeling? But then also, do you feel like one has to come to, like, some sort of ideology, like what you were saying, reincarnation, or mm-hmm. some people turn to, like, Christianity or something like that?
Some comforting philosophy.
Yeah.
So I'm going to answer the first part, but then I want to ask you a question. What you're experiencing is an unpleasant mind state. And so from this perspective, it's calling for compassion. It's calling, not trying to get rid of it, not trying to suppress it, but to really just turn towards it with mindfulness and say, this fear, this debilitating fear, is experienced as really unpleasant. And can I just bring compassion to this fear and this not knowing and the insecurity of that? And so you can use your practice not to get rid of it or to comfort it or to, but just to relate to that repetitive fear and insecurity of not knowing. So there's a practical way to use your meditation around that. And then maybe you have a clear knowing already, but I was just curious of, why is it important to know?
I think because I have so much anxiety around it. I think it feels important because I guess, I don't know, I guess I want to know if something terrible is going to happen. I want to know if this is meaningless. So
is it meaningless if it's lights out at death? If how you show up and how you relate and what you do in this lifetime, does the fact that there's no, the possibility or the fact that there's no continued existence make your life here and now meaningless? And what if there is eternalism? What if heaven or hell forever? Is that going to change the way you behave in this life? Are you going to stop stealing, lying, cheating? I'm not you, but you, all of the rest of you. If that, I mean, you know, I'm just asking, and I'm not just her, all of us. Like, if you look at the three, let's say there's three possibilities. There's rebirth, there's eternalism, eternally ever after, up above or down below, or there's just lights out, nihilism, just that's it, science. Oh, you scientists in here, that's it, you're done. When I do this experiment with myself, it doesn't change how I'm going to live my life. I'm going to do my best, no matter what, to end suffering in me and around me, whether or not there's anything after this. The fact that I think it's probably rebirth doesn't really change. I know that whether rebirth or not, I know that if I'm unskillful, I suffer more here and now. I don't like suffering. I want to not suffer. Here and now. I'm not worried about the afterlife. I'm worried about here and now. So for me, I just ask you, the reason I ask is just to investigate that and to bring the Dharma to, okay, this is just unpleasant and my mind's just, the ego just wants to know. And the Buddha, sometimes when people would ask him these questions, he'd say, these are just, it's unknowable. And even if I could tell you for sure, 100%, it won't end your suffering. Only you're going to end your suffering through how you're relating to the unpleasant mind states and sensations and emotions and grief and loss. And what happens next from the Buddha's, he wasn't constantly talking about incarnation. When, you know, asked, it's part of the philosophy. But it's much more practical at what's happening here and now. Present time, this lifetime. So I hope that's useful, you know, just as an investigation. And not that you're going to stop your mind from doing it, but just bring compassion and forgiveness to your mind. And it's that, when I talked about in the beginning, abandon trying to figure it out would be the encouragement. Stop feeding that repetitive thought. It's going to keep coming by itself, but we don't have to feed it. You see, like, oh, this is just suffering. I know, I've had been thinking about this for so long, and it's just suffering. I don't want to suffer so much. I'm going to stop intentionally thinking about that. I'm going to let it go. I'm going to bring my attention back to the present, here, now. Andy, do you have a question?
Yeah,
go ahead.
It wasn't a question so much. So I've been coming here for, 10 years, and when you would have death night talks. I couldn't stay in the room. And some of my friends who were Dharma teachers, they would actually text me and say, I'm going to talk about death tonight, so I didn't have to come. And I was just feeling how much calmer I am in my body now. Something happened a little while ago where, you know, in AA you do inventory, you're just checking with yourself. I don't do like a 10th step or anything anymore. But I started doing this thing where at the end of the day I would ask, or what I wanted was, did I do right by myself today? Did I, if this was my last day on earth, did I do right by myself? And then the other thing was, did I do right by everybody else? And something's just changed where if this were my last day, I want to be able to look myself in the eye and say, you know, I did right by you. I gave you a good life today, whatever happened in it. And I would definitely want that with other people. And what I've really found is, like, in terms of an internal conflict that has to do with death, is it is very scary to open my heart and love with the amount of love I have in me and possibly get fucked. And it's not, I mean, like, it's just possibly, like, it started first with animals, like, oh my God, I love this dog so much, it's going to kill me when he dies, you know, unless I die first. And that there's just something about love and death, just that ultimate, am I going to open and love and get fucked? So,
yes.
Yeah. I decided I wanted to do it anyway, but it's taken 10 years of circling this thing. I mean, I can't even believe I'm sitting here and I didn't leave, didn't Uber home. But, And another thing is I just started doing your dad's book again, A Year to Live. I don't know if it's always offered here every year, but it's such an important practice. It's such a great way to stick your toe in there. You know, like, go, this is important that you're alive, right? It's important that I'm alive right now. That's kind of what shifted my perspective is, this is very important. Anyway, good for me, right? 10 years later.
Hanging around a Dharma can be like exposure therapy to death. Even if you want to be completely in denial about it, there's going to be a Dharma talk every 6 months about death, and you're going to get exposed to it, and you're going to have to reflect on it. Yeah. So, yeah, in the, yeah. Or to, ignore. I feel that in my own process sometimes, that wanting to ignore it, suppress it. That there's that. It's the second noble truth in Buddhism: craving for something more pleasant. Grief is unpleasant, so it's hard for us to sit with. And so we want to do something. We want to fix it. We want to replace it. We want to ignore it, suppress it. This is all of what we're doing in the Dharma: is learning to be. Even in unpleasantness. I feel like sitting meditation, I don't know how long you've been sitting, but I can really look at my practice and be like, the more I learned how to sit still and be uncomfortable with the sensations, the pain, physical pain, the more I was able to sit with my emotional pain. That before I learned how to sit still and be uncomfortable, and every time I was uncomfortable, I would just do something about it. I was doing that emotionally all the time too. And there's something about sitting practice, going on retreats and sitting daily or regularly, and building that tolerance, saying, I know how to be really, I'm good at being uncomfortable. I'm like actually a professional at being uncomfortable. And the more you can do it physically, the more you can do it emotionally, and saying, okay, oh, this is just unpleasant. This is just grief. I can just be with this. And it's a skill that is developed over time. And so I don't have an easy, because I'm like, just do this. The answer is be with it as much as you can. And the more you meditate, the more you are with it. Now, often when there's a lot of grief, the mind's saying, like, don't meditate. You'll have to just sit with that shit. Go do, you know, distract yourself. Turn on the television. Don't feel it. Distract yourself. But it all comes back to the intimacy with it. And then the more we do that, the more we understand it's impermanent. Grief, like all strong emotions, tends to, in my experience, it tends to have this message of like, I'm going to stay forever. Right? That delusional message. I'm going to stay forever. But nothing stays forever. No experience, no emotion, no grief. It has a beginning, a middle, an end. It's a process. And then it passes and maybe it re-arises. So we sit with it, we get tolerant of it, and we start to understand that it's an impermanent process that needs our tending to. So maybe a couple more comments, please.
In that tending, I once had a teacher say to me, when I was searching for some relief over the death of my sister, overdose, she said, you are not going to ever, she said, forget about the ending, certainly forget about trying to attain relief from that sorrow. She said, put your energy into braiding your sorrow for your sister with your love of your sister. Braid those two actions of your heart together and live the rest of your life embracing that braid, and it will change over your lifetime. To me, that's a doable, non-philosophical,
yes,
non-dharma teaching.
Right.
And I've used it with great relief.
And I like it because it's to me, I have to reflect on it more, but I like it. I trust it right away because it's not comforting.
Yeah. Yes. I thought of that, if I may, when you talked about giving yourself the comfort of assessing the reason for the death of a child. I got into this once with Reb Anderson, and my understanding of the Dharma is that neither the Buddha, and certainly not us, should be looking for reasons for suffering, but only the causes of suffering, which in the case of children can be culture, karma, mm-hmm. can be many different things. Mm-hmm. And that if we protect ourselves against finding the reason, then we open ourselves to that braid. Nothing is more lovable. Well, children are very lovable. And so when we braid our sorrow of their early death with our love of them, that's the teaching, not some conceptual, how do we make ourselves feel better about it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I like it. I like it, and the big piece that I got from what you were saying is that looking for the reason.
Yeah.
And maybe it was my father who used to say, perhaps why is the wrong question.
Mm. Yeah.
Especially around death, around suicide, around, why then, why now, why is this relationship over?
Right.
And that a lot of what we can do is reframe it with not why, not trying to figure it out, not why do we exist or do we have, reframing it into what is the response that will end suffering here.
Yeah.
Not why is this happening,
yeah.
but how do I braid this? How do I relate to this? How do I show up with this? How do I feel this experience in a way that will alleviate the unnecessary cause of suffering, the layer on top, and just be with the grief without the blame, without the resentment, without the confusion? Probably enough for tonight. Sure, our last one.
It's a bit of a distraction, but we have a special group visiting us tonight, an age group that doesn't normally come here. I couldn't help but wonder if there were certain things that, from your perspective now, that you wished Noah had been told as a teenager. If you could share any of that, however briefly, a handful, one or two things that might speak to some of our special guests.
And that's a hard question for me. I started meditating when I was 17, and I've continued meditating ever since, for almost 30 years now. And in my early teens, I was just like, I couldn't understand, like, meditation seemed like such a waste of time. Like, what are you guys doing? I didn't get it. My parents were meditators. But by the time I was 17, I was suffering so much, and that I just felt desperate enough to try meditation. And I don't know what your guys' experience of the practice was tonight, but when I started practicing right away, I found some hope. I found like a tool that initially was just like, I didn't know I didn't have to obey my own mind. I'd been obeying my mind the first half, up until that point, and my mind had been creating all of this suffering for me, and just that first intervention that mindfulness is, like, I can pay attention to my breath instead of the greed, hatred, and delusion in my mind. And so that was a huge shift for me, or insight, or just information I didn't have. So I don't know. I mean, it's too big. Most of the time through my teen years, nobody could tell me anything. And I feel like that's often true for most of us until we're ready. Nobody can tell us. Even the best advice lands on deaf ears until the listener is ready to hear it. But it is said that the Dharma should be taught in a way that is straightforward and simple and could be understood by a very young person. I think that the Buddha said by somebody who is 7 years old or older. and that those who complicate the teachings and are not teaching the pure Dharma, that is really quite supposed to be quite simple. Everything's impermanent, don't cling to it. Compassion is the only rational response to grief and pain. Learn to care about pain. You know, really that simple is what the it said. The Buddha was really keeping it very simple. So, welcome to you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we need to end there because we're out of time for tonight.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.